The Salmon of Doubt, Disc 3.
The Rhino Climb. Great wumps of equatorial heat are coming up at me from off the tarmac. It's the short, rainy season in Kenya, but the sun burned off the morning dampness in minutes. I'm slathered in sunblock. The road stretches off into the distant heat haze and my legs are settling in nicely. Dotted along the road ahead and behind me are other walkers, some striding vigorously, others appearing just to amble, but all in fact moving at the same speed. One of them is wearing a large grey sculptural edifice made out of a painted woven plastic fabric stretched over a metal frame. A large horn bobs along in front of it. The thing is a grotesque but oddly beautiful caricature of a rhinoceros moving along with swift, busy strides. The sun beats down. Lopsided lorries grind their way dangerously past us. The drivers shout and grin at our rhinoceros. When we pass, as we frequently do, lorries that have clearly just rolled over and collapsed on the side of the road, we wonder if it was anything to do with us. The other walkers have all been walking for several days now, from the shore at Mombasa, along the main highway to the truck stop at Voi, the local centre of the universe. I joined them here last night, rattling in by Land Rover from Nairobi with my sister Jane, who's been doing some work for Save the Rhino International, which is what we are all here to support. From here, we will follow the road on as the tarmac gradually peters out towards the Tanzanian border. Over the border lies Mount Kilimanjaro, the tallest mountain in the world. It is to the peak of Kilimanjaro that the expedition is intending to climb, a small bunch of Englishmen out walking miles a day in the midday sun and taking turns at wearing a large rhino costume. Mad dogs have thrown in the towel long ago. What's this, I expect you're thinking, about the tallest mountain in the world? Everest surely deserves at least an honourable mention in this category. Well, it all depends on your point of view. Certainly, Everest stands a sturdy 29,028 feet above sea level, which is, in its way, impressive. But if you were going to climb Everest, you would probably start, if you were using a reliable guide, somewhere in the Himalayas. Anywhere in the Himalayas is pretty damn high to start with, and so, to hear some people tell it, it's just a smartish jog to do the last little bit to the actual top of Everest. The way to keep it interesting these days is to do it without oxygen, or in your underpants or something. But Kilimanjaro is not part of a widespread upheaval like Everest. It was a long time before people managed to work out which bit of the Himalayas was actually the highest, and the discovery was finally made, as I recall, on a desk in London. No such problem with Kilimanjaro. It's volcanic, and stands on its own surrounded by a few footling little hills. When you finally get to see Kili, searching among the befuddling clouds on the horizon, your blood suddenly runs cold. Oh, you say at last. You mean above the clouds. Your whole head tilts upwards. Oh, my God! From base to apex, it is the tallest mountain in the world. It's certainly a hell of a thing to climb in a rhino costume. This crackpot idea was first put to me months earlier by the founders of Save the Rhino International, David Sterling and Johnny Roberts, and I didn't realize at first that they meant it. They raved on for a bit about having acquired a whole set of rhino costumes that Ralph Steadman had designed for an opera, and that they would be just the thing for making the ascent of Kilimanjaro in. They had already been used, David told me by way of reassurance, for running in the New York Marathon. It'll have enormous impact, they said. Believe me, really. I began to realize the truth of this as we approached our first village of the day, and perhaps now would be a good point to explain what the purpose of the whole expedition was. It was not, in fact, to raise money directly for rhino conservation. Rhinos, which used to be plentiful on the plains of East Africa, are now hideously rare, but in Kenya they are about as well conserved as they can be anywhere in Africa. Richard Leakey's Kenya Wildlife Service consists of 8,000 well-trained, well-equipped, well-armed, highly motivated soldiers and represents a formidable force. Too formidable, some of his opponents feel. Poaching in Kenya is, officially, no longer a problem. But conservation is a continually evolving business, and we have begun to realize that just wading into Africa and telling the local people that they mustn't do to their wildlife what we've done to ours, and that we are there to make sure they don't, is an attitude that, to say the least, needs a little refining. The communities that live along the margins of the great national parks have a tough time. They are poor, undernourished, their lands are restricted by the parks, and when, from time to time, the odd lion or elephant breaks out of the park, they are the ones who suffer. Arguments about preserving the genetic diversity of the planet can seem a little abstract to someone who has just lost the crops he needs to feed his family, or worse, has just lost one of his family. In the long run, conservation can't be imposed by outsiders, overriding the needs of local people. If anyone is going to take care of the wildlife, then, in the end, it must be the local people, and someone must take care of them. Our route took us alongside and sometimes through the great national parks of Tsavo East and Tsavo West, and it was the people who lived on these perimeters that we had come to visit and also to help. The £100,000 we were hoping to raise from the walk would be spent on building school classrooms, stocking libraries, and paying for other community projects. We wanted to encourage them to see that whatever problems the wildlife may pose to them, it was of benefit to them as well. As we were approaching our first village of the day, the rhino, with Todd Jones inside it, was in the lead. All the walkers took turns at wearing the thing for an hour at a time, and you quickly learned to tell who was in it at any moment from the way in which it moved. If the rhino sauntered, then it was Giles inside. Giles was an ex-Gordonston Hugh Grant lookalike who had spent the last few years hitchhiking languidly around Africa with his own parachute. His technique was to turn up at airfields with this parachute, find someone who was flying in the general direction he wanted to go, hitch a lift, and then, when the fancy took him, just jump out of the plane. Apparently, his girlfriend was a top supermodel who every few months would find out where he was, fly out there, and then, I'm guessing here, have him washed and sent up to her hotel room. If the rhino ambled along in a genial way, then it was Tom inside. Tom was a tall Woodhouseian man with exactly the wrong complexion for Africa. He had the amiable air of a member of the landed gentry, and when I asked him where he lived, he said in a vague kind of way, "Shropshire." If the rhino bustled along busily, it was Todd inside. Todd was not a mad Englishman, because he was Welsh. He was in charge of the rhino costumes, and had worn them originally in the opera for which they had been designed, during which he had had to carry enormously heavy sopranos on his back. He told me that he had originally wanted to be a vet, but had ended up instead being a succession of animals instead. Any time you see a film or TV show or a commercial which features someone dressed up as an animal, it's probably Todd inside. "I was in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe," he told me. "Guess," he added, "which one I was." One evening he showed me pictures of his family. Here was a beautiful picture of his wife, another of his young daughter, a sweet picture of his baby son, and here was one of Todd himself. Todd was done up, very convincingly, as a bright blue centaur. As Todd Rhino bustled along, suddenly huge crowds of children erupted onto the road ahead of us and hurried towards us, singing and dancing and chanting, "Rhino! Rhino! Rhino!" We were quickly surrounded and escorted the last few hundred yards to where they had prepared a reception for us in the village square. The whole village had turned out to greet us with enormous enthusiasm. We sat and watched, panting in the heat and sluicing ourselves down with bottled water, as the children of the village put on a display of dancing and choral singing that was, frankly, amazing. When I say children, I'm not just talking about 7-year-olds. I'm talking about 17-year-olds as well. It's odd that we don't any more have a comfortable word that covers the whole range. Youngsters? Patronizing. Kids? No. Youths? Sounds as if they've just broken into a warehouse and stolen something. Children, then. The children had written a song about rhinos, which they then sang for us. In the background, Giles had quietly taken over from Todd in the rhino suit, and after a while he joined in the dancing, lolloping and swaying around, chasing and playing with the children, before finally dodging off behind a tree for a quick ciggy. We then, with slightly less enthusiasm, sat through a series of speeches that some local dignitaries had turned up to deliver. Wherever we went, there were local dignitaries, keen to be seen, to be associated with us. Gradually, the whole point of the rhino suit was beginning to dawn on me. The arrival of the rhino and the rhino climb team was something that the village had been looking forward to and preparing for months. It was the biggest event of the year, a carnival, a festival, a holiday. Being visited by a rhino was something that would be remembered by the villagers, and particularly the children, for years in a way that being visited by a bunch of English toffs in hats would not. We were then taken to see the village school. Like most of the village, it was made of breeze blocks and was half-finished. The doors and windows were empty holes. The furniture was just a few rickety benches and some trestle tables. And laid out on these were dozens of pictures of the local wildlife, which the children had drawn, and which we were to judge and give prizes for. The prizes were Rhino Climb baseball hats, and whoever won the prizes, we had to make sure that every member of the village actually got a hat. And once we have collected our sponsorship money, we will be able to complete the building of their schoolroom for them. When at last we left, the children danced along with us for several miles, laughing and singing improvised songs. One of them would start, and the others would quickly pick it up and join in. The words seem oddly dated, don't they? It all sounds rather naive and sentimental to be talking about children laughing and dancing and singing together, when we all know perfectly well that what children do in real life is snarl and take drugs. But these children, kids, youths, and all the ones we came across on our journey were happy in a way that we in the West are almost embarrassed by. The last of the children drops away from us. Our support Land Rover drives slowly past, distributing Cokes and Fantas. Jim, our photographer, is sitting on its tailgate, taking pictures of us with his Canon EOS-1, which I've been coveting ever since I saw it. Kees, our Dutch video cameraman, hoists his lightweight Sony 3-chip up to his shoulder and pans along the line of walkers. I wonder if there's anywhere in the West that you could find 100 children to sing and dance like that. The following day is my first stint in the rhino suit. I'm much too big for it, and my legs stick out absurdly from the bottom, so that I look like a giant prawn tempura. Inside, the heat and the stench of stale sweat and old Dettol are almost overpowering until you get into the swing of things. Todd walks along beside me, determinedly keeping me engaged in conversation. After a while, I realize he's monitoring me to make sure I don't faint. Todd's a good man, and I like him a lot. He takes good care of people and takes even better care of his beloved rhino suit. I stop for a moment to pour some water into and over my face and catch a glimpse of myself in the window of the Land Rover. I look unimaginably stupid, and I reflect that there is something very odd about this sponsored walking business. It's always undertaken for good causes, cancer research, famine relief, wildlife conservation, and so on, but the deal seems to be this. Okay, you are trying to raise funds for this very worthwhile cause, and I can see that it's an important and crucial matter, and that lives or indeed whole species are at stake, and something needs to be done as a matter of urgency. But, well, I don't know. Tell you what, do something really pointless and stupid and maybe a bit dangerous, then I'll give you some money. I only spent a week on the walk. I didn't get to climb Kilimanjaro, though I did get to see it. I was very sorry not to get to go up it. Though, having seen it, I have to say I wasn't very, very sorry. I did get to see one rhino, briefly, out of the thousands that used to roam in this area, and I wondered if it had any sense at all that all was not right with its world. Human beings have been on this planet for 1 million years or so, and in that time we have faced all sorts of threats to our survival. Famine, plague, warfare, AIDS. Rhinoceroses have been here for 40 million years, and just one threat has brought them to the brink of extinction. Human beings. We are not the only species to have caused devastation to the rest of the world, and it must be said in our favour that we are the only one that has become aware of the consequences of its behaviour and tried to do something about it. However, I reflect as I shift the costume back into a comfortable walking posture and squint forward over its bobbing plastic horn, we do go about it in some odd ways. 1993, Completely Unexpected Productions Limited. For children only. You will need to know the difference between Friday and a fried egg. It's quite a simple difference, but an important one. Friday comes at the end of the week, whereas a fried egg comes out of a hen. Like most things, of course, it isn't quite that simple. The fried egg isn't properly a fried egg until it's been put in a frying pan and fried. This is something you wouldn't do to a Friday, of course, though you might do it on a Friday. You can also fry eggs on a Thursday, if you like, or on a cooker. It's all rather complicated, but it makes a kind of sense if you think about it for a while. It's also good to know the difference between a lizard and a blizzard. This is quite an easy one. Though the two things sound very much alike, you find them in such very different parts of the world that it is a very simple matter to tell them apart. If you are somewhere inside the Arctic Circle, then what you are looking at is probably a blizzard. Whereas, if you are in a hot and dry place like Madagascar or Mexico, it's more likely to be a lizard. This animal is a lemur. There are lots of different kinds of lemurs, and they nearly all live in Madagascar. Madagascar is an island, a very large island, much, much larger than your hat, but not as large as the moon. The moon is much larger than it appears to be. This is worth remembering, because next time you are looking at the moon, you can say in a deep and mysterious voice, "The moon is much larger than it appears to be," and people will know that you are a wise person who has thought about this a lot. This particular kind of lemur is called a ring-tailed lemur. Nobody knows why it is called this, and generations of scientists have been baffled by it. One day, a very wise person indeed will probably work out why it is called a ring-tailed lemur. If this person is exceedingly wise, then he or she will only tell very close friends in secret, because otherwise everybody will know it, and then nobody will realize how wise the first person to know it really was. Here are two more things you should know the difference between: road and woad. One is a thing that you drive along in a car or on a bicycle, and the other is a kind of blue body paint that British people used to wear thousands of years ago instead of clothes. Usually it's quite easy to tell these two apart, but if you find it at all difficult to say your R's properly, it can lead to terrible confusion. Imagine trying to ride a bicycle on a small patch of blue paint, or have to dig up an entire street just to have something to wear if you fancy spending the evening with some druids. Druids used to live thousands of years ago. They used to wear long white robes and have very strong opinions about what a wonderful thing the sun was. Do you know what an opinion is? I expect someone in your family has probably got one, so you could ask them to tell you about it. Asking people about their opinions is a very good way of making friends. Telling them about your own opinions can also work, but not always quite as well. Nowadays, most people know what a wonderful thing the sun is, so there aren't many druids around anymore, but there are still a few, just in case it slips our mind from time to time. If you find someone who has a long white robe and talks about the sun a lot, then you might have found a druid. If he turns out to be about 2,000 years old, then that's a sure sign. If the person you found has got a slightly shorter white coat with buttons up the front, then it may be that he is an astronomer and not a druid. If he is an astronomer, then one of the things you could ask him is how far away the sun is. The answer will probably startle you a lot. If it doesn't, then tell him from me that he hasn't explained it very well. After he's told you how far away the sun is, ask him how far away some of the stars are. That will really surprise you. If you can't find an astronomer yourself, then ask your parents to find one for you. They don't all wear white coats, which is one of the things that sometimes makes them hard to spot. Some of them wear jeans or even suits. When we say that something is startling, we mean that it surprises us a very great deal. When we say that something is a starling, we mean that it is a type of migratory bird. Bird is a word we use quite often, which is why it's such an easy word to say. Most of the words we use often, like house and car and tree, are easy to say. Migratory is a word we don't use nearly so much, and saying it can sometimes make you feel as if your teeth are stuck together with toffee. If birds were called migratories rather than birds, we probably wouldn't talk about them nearly so much. We all say, "Look, there's a dog," or "There's a cat." But if a migratory went by, we'd probably just say, "Is it tea time yet?" and not even mention it, however nifty it looked. But migratory doesn't mean that something is stuck together with toffee, however much it sounds like it. It means that something spends part of the year in one country and part of it in another. Hours doing something wild and daring with absolute self-confidence. When Bach wrote it, he put himself at the harpsichord instead of the viola he more usually played in ensembles. It was at a happy, productive time of his life when he was at last surrounded by some good musicians. The harpsichord, traditionally, played a supporting role in this kind of group, but not this time. Bach let rip. As you listen to the first movement, you hear something strange, new and terrifying, giving birth to itself. Or maybe it's a giant engine, or even a great horse being prepared for a Herculean task, surrounded by, you can't help jumbling metaphors when language tries to keep up with music, a flotilla of helpers fussing around it. You hear it ticking over, trotting, having a little canter here and there, getting a bit frisky, and then taking a trial run as its helpers encourage it onwards, keening with bated breath. It hauls itself back in again, does another quick circuit, and then the other instruments fall silent, It stands free and alone, pawing at the ground, breathing deeply, gathering its strength, trotting forward. And then it makes its move, running, hurtling, flying, climbing, clambering, pushing, panting, twisting, thrashing, pounding at the ground, pounding, pounding, suddenly breaking away, running onwards desperately, and then with one last little unexpected step up in the bass, it's home and free. The main tune charges in triumphantly, and it's all over bar the weeping and dancing. That is, the second and third movements. The familiarity of the Brandenburgs should not blind us to their magnitude. I'm convinced that Bach is the greatest genius who ever walked among us. And the Brandenburgs are what he wrote when he was happy. He's in the house, so forget Frank. You're lucky. You can. Now the point is this. The house is here. Building this house is the purpose of the whole exercise. If I want anything done in it, I pick up the phone, assuming Frank hasn't hacked through the line trying to get at a light switch, and someone comes round to the house and does it. If I want to have some cupboards installed, I don't have to do the following. I don't have to have the house completely dismantled, shipped up to Birmingham, where the carpenter is, put together again in a way that a carpenter understands, then have the carpenter work on it, and then have the whole thing dismantled again, shipped back down to Islington, and put together again so that it works as a house that I can live in. So why do I have to do that on my computer? Let me put that another way so that it makes sense. Why, when I'm working in a document in one word processor, do I keep on finding that if I want to do something else to the document, I have virtually to dismantle the document and ship it over to another word processor, which has a feature I need that the first one doesn't? Why don't I just use the second word processor? Well, because it doesn't have other features that the first one does, of course. Or, if I want to put a picture in it, why do I have to go off to another program entirely and do the picture there, and then go through all the mind-numbing palaver of discovering that, for some reason, the WP I'm using doesn't know how to handle graphics in that particular format, or claims that it does, but then just goes all black and sulky, or makes the machine go bing when I actually ask it to? In the end, I have to paste all the various bits into PageMaker, which then refuses to print for some reason. I know that MultiFinder has made all this a bit easier, but it's really just the equivalent of making Birmingham easier to get to, if you follow me. Entirely. What I'm talking about is the death of the application. I don't mean just when they unexpectedly quit. I mean it's time we simply got rid of them. And getting hold of the tools I need should be as simple as pasting a button into HyperCard. Ah, HyperCard. I know it's unfashionable to say this, because a lot of people feel that HyperCard simply isn't powerful enough to do useful work in. It is, after all, a first stab at an idea that's in its infancy. The list of things you can't do with it is almost as long as the list of macros in Nisus. What are all those things? The very act of pulling down the macros menu causes lights to dim all over North London. But it's a sensationally good idea, and I would dearly love to see something like it become the whole working environment for the Mac. You want the number-crunching power of Excel? Paste it in. You want animation? Paste in Director. You don't like the way Director works? You must be mad. It's brilliant. Paste in the bits you like of any other animation tools you find lying about. Or even rewrite it. If it's properly written in object-oriented code, it should be as easy as writing HyperTalk. All right, you can't write HyperTalk. It should be easier to write than HyperTalk. Just point at the bits you like and click. We should not have to be tyrannized by application designers who don't know the first thing about how actual people do their actual work. We should be able to just pick up the bits we like and paste them in. This is ridiculous. Dickens didn't have to crawl around under his desk trying to match plugs. You look at the sheer yardage of Dickens' output on a shelf, and you know he never had to match plugs. All I want to do is print from my portable, poor baby. That isn't all I want, in fact. I want to be able regularly to transfer my address book and diary stacks backwards and forwards between my portable and my 2X, and all my current half-finished chapters, and anything else I'm tinkering with, which is the reason why my half-finished chapters are half-finished. In other words, I want my portable to appear on the desktop of my 2X. I don't want to have to do battle with cupboard monsters and then mess about with tops every time I want that to happen. I'll tell you all I want to have to do in order to get my portable to appear on the desktop of my 2X. I just want to carry it into the same room. Bang! There it is. It's on the desktop. This is infrared talk. Or maybe it's microwave talk. I don't really care any more than I want to care about PICTs and TIFFs and RTFs and SILKs and all the other acronyms which merely say, we've got a complicated problem, so here's a complicated answer to it. Let me make one thing clear. I adore my Macintosh, or rather my family of however many Macintoshes it is that I've recklessly accumulated over the years. I've adored it since I first saw one at Infocom's offices in Boston in 1983. The thing that has kept me enthralled and hypnotized by it in all that time is the perception which lies at the heart of its design, which is this. There is no problem so complicated that you can't find a very simple answer to it if you look at it the right way. Or, to put it another way, the future of computer power is pure simplicity. So my two major wishes for the 1990s are that the Macintosh systems designers get back to that future, and that Frank the Vandal gets out of my house. Written in 1989 for Mac User. It was a typewriter! So we began to develop it as a super typewriter, with a long and increasingly incomprehensible feature list. Users of Microsoft Word will know what I'm talking about. The next breakthrough came when we started to make these numbers, which were now flying round inside these machines at insane speeds, stand for the picture elements of a graphical display. Pixels! Aha, we thought. This machine turns out to be much more exciting even than a typewriter. It's a television, with a typewriter stuck in front of it. And now we have the World Wide Web. The only thing I know of whose shortened form, www, takes three times longer to say than what it's short for. And we have yet another exciting new model. It's a brochure! A huge, all-singing, all-dancing, hopping, beeping, flash-ridden brochure. Of course, the computer isn't any of these things. These are all things we were previously familiar with from the real world, which we have modelled in the computer, so that we can use the damn thing. Which should tell us something interesting. The computer is actually a modelling device. Once we see that, we ought to realise that we can model anything in it. Not just things we are used to doing in the real world, but the things the real world actually prevents us from doing. Picture? Like real-world shops, they can only record the sales they actually make. What about the sales they don't make and don't know that they haven't made because they haven't made them? I went on to Amazon the other day because I wanted to order the 1968 Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet on DVD. Turns out it doesn't exist. I could buy it on VHS, but I don't want it on VHS. So the whole transaction was null. There was no way of recording that I came in looking to buy something and that the something I wanted to buy wasn't there. I only got to select, or not select, from what happened to be available. I didn't get to be able to say what I actually wanted. So I wrote to them about it, and guess what? Now you can. They're very smart like that. They are now able to supply the studios with information about what there is actually demand for out there. And on the basis of another, not entirely disinterested, suggestion of mine, they are going to start a running poll on which books people would most like to see turned into movies. This is information that no one has ever been able to collect before. But let us take this one stage further. How often have you looked through a brochure or a catalogue and thought, I wish somebody would write a book about, or if only somebody made a bicycle with a, or why doesn't somebody make a screwdriver that, or why don't they make that in blue? A brochure can't answer you, but the web can. What is the thing you'd really love to have if only someone had the sense to make one? Suggestions, please, to www.h2g2.com. Independent on Sunday. I've come up with a set of rules that describe our reactions to technologies. Rule 1. Anything that is in the world when you're born is normal and ordinary and is just a natural part of the way the world works. 2. Anything that's invented between when you're 15 and 35 are new and exciting and revolutionary, and you can probably get a career in it. 3. Anything invented after you're 35 is against the natural order of things. Daughter, when she tells me that she didn't make that mess on the floor. I believe in justice and fair play, though I don't know exactly how we achieve them, other than by continually trying against all possible odds of success. I also believe that England should enter the European Monetary Union. I am not remotely enough of an economist to argue the issue vigorously with someone who is, but what little I do know, reinforced with a hefty dollop of gut feeling, strongly suggests to me that it's the right course. I could very easily turn out to be wrong, and I know that. These seem to me to be legitimate uses for the word believe. As a carapace for the protection of irrational notions from legitimate questions, however, I think that the word has a lot of mischief to answer for. So I do not believe that there is no God. I am, however, convinced that there is no God, which is a totally different stance and takes me on to my second reason. I don't accept the currently fashionable assertion that any view is automatically as worthy of respect as any equal and opposite view. My view is that the moon is made of rock. If someone says to me, "Well, you haven't been there, have you? You haven't seen it for yourself, so my view that it is made of Norwegian beaver cheese is equally valid," then I can't even be bothered to argue. There is such a thing as the burden of proof, and in the case of God, as in the case of the composition of the moon, this has shifted radically. God used to be the best explanation we'd got, and we've now got vastly better ones. God is no longer an explanation of anything, but has instead become something that would itself need an insurmountable amount of explaining. So I don't think that being convinced that there is no God is as irrational or arrogant a point of view as belief that there is. I don't think the matter calls for even-handedness at all. Ported in logic and argument than others. So, I was already familiar with, and, I'm afraid, accepting of, the view that you couldn't apply the logic of physics to religion, that they were dealing with different types of truth. I now think this is baloney, but to continue. What astonished me, however, was the realization that the arguments in favor of religious ideas were so feeble and silly, next to the robust arguments of something as interpretive and opinionated as history. In fact, they were embarrassingly childish. They were never subject to the kind of outright challenge which was the normal stock in trade of any other area of intellectual endeavor whatsoever. Why not? Because they wouldn't stand up to it. So I became an agnostic. And I thought and thought and thought. But I just did not have enough to go on, so I didn't really come to any resolution. I was extremely doubtful about the idea of God, but I just didn't know enough about anything to have a good working model of any other explanation for, well, life, the universe, and everything to put in its place. But I kept at it, and I kept reading, and I kept thinking. Sometime around my early 30s, I stumbled upon evolutionary biology, particularly in the form of Richard Dawkins' books, The Selfish Gene, and then The Blind Watchmaker. And suddenly, on, I think, the second reading of The Selfish Gene, it all fell into place. It was a concept of such stunning simplicity, but it gave rise, naturally, to all of the infinite and baffling complexity of life. The awe it inspired in me made the awe that people talk about in respect of religious experience seem frankly silly beside it. I'd take the awe of understanding over the awe of ignorance any day. I tend not to come across people who watch daytime soaps or read the National Enquirer. And how do you usually respond? I wouldn't bother. American atheists. Have you faced any obstacles in your professional life because of your atheism? Bigotry against atheists? And how did you handle it? How often does this happen? Douglas. Not even remotely. It's an inconceivable idea. American atheists. There are quite a few light-hearted references to God and religion in your books. Quote, 2,000 years after some guy got nailed to a tree, end quote. How has your atheism influenced your writing? Where, in which characters or situations, are your personal religious thoughts most accurately reflected? Douglas, I am fascinated by religion. That's a completely different thing from believing in it. It has had such an incalculably huge effect on human affairs. What is it? What does it represent? Why have we invented it? How does it keep going? What will become of it? I love to keep poking and prodding at it. I've thought about it so much over the years that that fascination is bound to spill over into my writing. American Atheists, what message would you like to send to your atheist fans? Douglas, hello, how are you? From The American Atheist, Volume 37, Number 1. What are the benefits of speaking to your fans via email? It's quicker, easier, and involves less licking. Said that he couldn't conceive of anybody needing more than 640K of memory in their computers. Try running Word in even 20 times that. It would be interesting to keep a running log of predictions and see if we can spot the absolute corkers when they are still just pert little buds. One such that I spotted recently was a statement made in February by a Mr. Wayne Luke, Vice President of Engineering at US West, the American phone company. Arguing against the deployment of high-speed wireless data connections, he said, "Granted, you could use it in your car going 60 miles an hour, but I don't think too many people are going to be doing that." Just watch. That's a statement that will come back to haunt him. Satellite navigation, wireless internet. As soon as we start mapping physical location back into shared information space, we will trigger yet another explosive growth in internet applications. At least, that's what I predict. I could, of course, be wildly wrong. Stuart Brand, in his excellent book, The Clock of the Long Now, proposes keeping a record of society's predictions and arguments in a 10,000-year library. But it will also be interesting to see how things work out in the short term. At the beginning of each new year, the media tend to be full of predictions of what is going to happen over the course of the following year. 2 days later, of course, they're forgotten, and we never get to test them. So I'd like to invite readers to submit their own predictions, or any others they come across in print, of what is going to happen in the next 5 years and when. Will we set off to Mars? Will we get peace in Ireland or the Middle East? Will the e-commerce bubble burst? We'll put them up on the web, where they will stay for that whole period, so we can track them against what actually happens. Predicting the future is a mug's game, but any game is improved when you can actually keep the score. Independent on Sunday. There's now a new generation of smarter office chair beginning to arrive that makes a virtue of doing away with all the knobs and levers. All the springing and bracing we learned about is still there, but it adjusts to your posture and movement automatically without you having to tell it how to. All right, here's a prediction for you. When we have software that works like that, the world will truly be a better and happier place. Because when the Tsar, I don't know which Tsar it was, because I'm not in my study at home, I'm leaning against something shamefully ugly in Michigan and there are no books, decreed that the Trans-Siberian Railway should be built, he drew a line on a map with a ruler. The ruler had a nick in it. I am writing this article leaning against some nameless architectural mistake, and I am not writing the article on a Mac. I would, but my PowerBook is fresh out of power. Funny notion to name the thing after its only major shortcoming. It's rather like Greenland in that respect. I have the power cable with me, but I can't plug it in anywhere. Though the power cable very cleverly has a universal power supply, it doesn't have a universal plug. It has a large, clunky, British-style 3-pin plug built right into it, which means that if you forget to buy an adapter plug before you leave Heathrow, you are completely and utterly screwed. You cannot buy an adapter for British plugs outside Britain. I know. I tried that when I ran into a similar problem with the old Mac Portable. I am not going to make any Mac Portable jokes. Apple made quite enough of them to be getting on with. Damn, I said I wasn't going to do that. In the end, I had to buy a US power cable. Or rather, I had to try and buy one. Couldn't be done. They only came with new Mac Portables. I heaved a dead Mac Portable around with me for 10 days, and occasionally ate my sandwiches off it because it was slightly lighter than carrying a table. Damn, there goes another one. Saved on duty is going into the coffers of the duty-free shops rather than helping to pay for the National Health Service and Trident. So why did I buy my Scion at the duty-free shop? Because I'm a complete idiot, that's why. Anyway, status update. They found me a room. I've unpacked my adapter plug. My PowerBook is charging itself up. I'm still not using it, though because I am now lying in the bath. So I'm still using the Scion. I have never, ever written anything in the bath before. Paper gets damp and steamy. Pens won't write upside down. Typewriters hurt your tummy. And if you are prepared to use a power book in the bath, then I assume that it isn't your own power book. So the thing is, it can be done. You can actually write on a palm-top computer, which is something I didn't realize before. I had tried to do it on a Sharp Wizard, but it wasn't possible because the keyboard was laid out alphabetically, which is hopeless. The principle behind the decision to have an alphabetical keyboard is based on a misunderstanding. I believe that the idea is this. Not everybody knows QWERTY. It's an odd feeling, actually, typing QWERTY as a word. Try it, and you'll see what I mean. But everybody knows the alphabet. This is true, but irrelevant. People know the alphabet as a one-dimensional string, not as a two-dimensional array. So you're going to have to hunt and peck anyway. So why not use QWERTY and let people who know it have the benefit? I also tried the larger Sharp Wizard, the 8200, which does have a QWERTY keyboard, but no word wrap. Can you believe that? Even Etch-A-Sketch has word wrap these days. And keyboard input, for the moment, means QWERTY. But QWERTY, as we know, was originally designed to slow down typists so the keys wouldn't jam. It's deliberately inefficient. However, all attempts to replace it with something more efficient, like the Dvorak keyboard, have failed. People know QWERTY already, and they don't have any pressing incentive to change. Dvorak et al. May be better, but QWERTY is, or has been till now, good enough. If it ain't bust, don't fix it, is a very sound principle, and remains so, despite the fact that I have slavishly ignored it all my life. I think, though, that we might finally have arrived at a point at which there is a strong incentive to reinvent the keyboard. Palm-top computers are where all the new action is. Apple and Microsoft and everybody are suddenly beginning to get revved up about personal digital assistants and stuff. And having been using this Scion Series 3A for a few hours now, so am I. It's terrific technology, and this is just the beginning. That crucial moment at which something stops being just an entertaining new toy and starts being something you can seriously use in the bath. We've all known for years that QWERTY isn't good. I think we've now got to that important point where it isn't even good enough. I hope that systems designers have not been put off by the failure of the Dvorak keyboard. I hope they are carefully studying the way that people hold palm-top computers, where their fingers naturally fall and fit, and how the whole idea of how a keyboard works can be rethought. I would very much like it if my thumb joints were now not stiff and aching. I've proved it can be done, but, like Branwell Bronte, I'm not expecting to do the same trick again tomorrow. Independent on Sunday. We notice things that don't work. We don't notice things that do. We notice computers. We don't notice pennies. We notice e-book readers. We don't notice books. An awful lot of the little dongly things, including the one that arrived this morning, are little dongly things that run on 120 volts AC, American voltage, which means I can't use them here in foreign state code FN. But I have to keep them in case I ever take the gizmo to which they fit, provided I know which gizmo it is they fit to the USA. What, you may ask, the hell am I talking about? The little dongly things I am concerned with, and they are by no means the only species of little dongly things with which the microelectronics world is infested, are the external power adapters which laptops and palm tops and external drives and cassette recorders and telephone answering machines and powered speakers and other incredibly necessary gizmos need to step down the mains AC supply from either 120 volts or 240 volts to 6 volts DC. Or 4.5 volts DC, or 9 volts DC, or 12 volts DC, at 500 milliamps, or 300 milliamps, or 1200 milliamps. They have positive tips and negative sleeves on their plugs, unless they are the type that has negative tips and positive sleeves. By the time you multiply all these different variables together, you end up with a fairly major industry, which exists, so far as I can tell, to fill my cupboards with little dongly things, none of which I can ever positively identify without playing gizmo Pelmanism. The usual method of finding a little dongly thing that actually matches a gizmo I want to use is to go and buy another, at a price that can physically drive the air from your body. Would be that you would only need one DC power adapter. Think of that! Well, not exactly one, you might need a dozen of them, but they would all be exactly the same. Just get a box of them. They'll just be a commodity item, like, well, I was going to say light bulbs, but light bulbs come in all sorts of different wattages and fittings. The great thing about having a DC power standard is that it would be much better than light bulbs. Apart from doing away with endless confusion and inconvenience, the arrival of a new standard would encourage all sorts of other new features to emerge. Power points in convenient places in cars, DC power points in homes and offices, and most importantly, DC power points in the armrests of aeroplane seats. I have to own up and say that much as I love my PowerBook, which now does about 97.8% of what I used to use the lumbering old desktop dinosaurs for, I've given up trying to use it on planes. Yes, yes, I know that there are all sorts of power user strategies you can use to extend your battery life, dimming modes, RAM disks, processor resting, and so on, but the point is that I really can't be bothered. I'm perfectly capable of just reading the in-flight magazine if I want to be irritated. However, if there was a DC power supply in my armrest, I would actually be able to do some work, or at least fiddle with stuff. I know that the airline companies will probably say, yes, but if we do that, our aeroplanes will fall out of the sky. But they always say that. I know that sometimes their planes do fall out of the sky, but, and here's the point, not nearly as often as the airline companies say they will. I, for one, would be willing to risk it. In the Great War against little dongly things, no sacrifice, I think, is too great. 1996, Completely Unexpected Productions Limited. We are stuck with technology when what we want, what we really want, is just stuff that works. How do we recognize something that is still technology? A good clue is if it comes with a manual.
This ends Disc 3.